You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
It's all gone. All is empty without word. Lost at sea, you dragged him down. Light up the
beach. Folks, quite a thrill for me to have Martin Joseph here in studio. Have a wee listen to one of his songs.
This boy is lost. He walked the sand. The sun was set in glory view. Just makes it worse, the light fades. And somewhere out there, angels wrestle for our lives.
Welsh-born singer-songwriter Martin Joseph is here on an extensive tour of Ontario, Because We Can tour, along with longtime songwriting partner, poet, and BBC radio presenter Stuart Henderson. Their first time touring together in Canada, this duo brings a poetry-infused, acoustically-driven, socially-aware commentary. Boy, that I'm not sure we can put any more adjectives in that sentence. Guys, welcome to our show. It's been an odd day for everybody, including us here in the studio, but for you, trying to get across the Gardner.
It was impossible.
Yeah.
But thanks to Brandon, our World Vision man on the road and sturdy driver, we got here.
Well done.
Without getting a ticket.
Right up the guts of London is where you're at?
Sorry, could you translate that?
Where are you at? Where is your headquarters? Where are you based at?
Oh, I see. Yes. Oh, so sorry. Fine.
Yes.
Fine. Okay, fine.
Smarty.
Yeah. Sparring match. BBC Network London, BBC Radio 4, is based in the main sort of BBC headquarters in London.
Right.
So my programme, Questions, Questions, which has been running now for 8 years, sometimes we go into Broadcasting House, but because of the way the BBC has devolved over the past 10, 15 years, an awful lot of programmes are outsourced.
Hmm.
So our production offices are in Southwark in southeast London. So we do the programmes there in a studio much smaller than this, in fact. In a voice studio much, much smaller.
Get out of here.
Yeah, honestly. No, it's half the size of this. But sometimes we'll have to go into BBC headquarters to do it down the line, say from the States or Canada or Australia.
BBC 4.
Radio 4.
Radio 4. Is there a... What, BBC Ulster? Is that not also BBC 4, BBC Ulster?
No, BBC Ulster... that would be... again, that's the dedicated network for Northern Ireland.
Right. Well, I thought they called it BBC 4 for some reason, but I guess
no,
not.
No, BBC Radio 4. BBC 4, in fact, is a television network, which does documentaries. Great music documentaries.
Do you know a fellow named Jerry Anderson?
Jerry Anderson worked, I don't know him personally, but Jerry Anderson has made some supreme programs for network BBC Radio. And, of course, he's got his own show on BBC Radio Ulster. And he is an outstanding broadcaster.
Good crack.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
I've, enjoyed it over the years.
Yeah.
Why are you two friends?
That's a good question.
No idea whatsoever.
We're not even sure where we met, because we at one point during the evening we opened ourselves to questions from the audience, and one of the ones we get asked often is where did we meet, and we really don't know. Stuart claims that it was a dating agency, but
that's creepy.
Yeah,
it was.
It
worked well.
We think it was probably a common interest at the Greenbelt Festival in the UK back in the 80s, and we know we wrote our first song together in about 87.
87.
Yeah. We're actually, why we're friends, because I love the guy, but we're very different, Stuart and I. Stuart is organized, Stuart is wise, Stuart is, everything is precise, and I'm the complete opposite, but we seem to make things work.
Somehow. Yeah. I think one of the things is when you find somebody creatively who you can actually, as Martin said, fuse with, it becomes, in effect, very easy to operate. Now, the actual creative process whereby I send Martin lyrics, he then basically makes the lyrics dance through his musicianship. The lead up to actually writing the song or forming the song can take a wee while, but once you hit it on the head, then that's it, you're away. You know, you really are bouncing.
Who else have you worked with musically, Stuart?
Musically, I've written a couple of songs for a singer-songwriter from Cardiff called Rachel Taylor Beals, who is a very fine singer-songwriter. But that's about it, really.
Juliet Taylor.
No. I didn't know. I didn't write for Juliet.
Do you aspire to work with someone greater than Martin?
No, they don't come any greater. No, not at all. Not in any way, shape,
or form. So if Sting phoned you and said, I'd like you to work on a song with me, I've heard you're quite the lyricist.
Yeah, but what's the fee? That's the first question.
This guy's cheeky, isn't he?
This guy's from Liverpool.
Unbelievable.
Did you know that? He's originally from Liverpool.
I picked it up.
Yeah, that's coming through.
And you're Welsh.
I am, through and through.
Now, listen, every time I think of the Welsh, I think of that dodgy character in Notting Hill.
Oh, right.
Comes to the door in his underwear.
With the t-shirt.
Yeah. you're sexier looking than he is, well, Martin.
That's not how.
Martin, yeah. I've had a ton of people over the years rattle on about you to me. And it's one of those things in the guitar, you know, they know that I appreciate the Tommy Emmanuels, the Joe Satriani, the Steve Vais, the David Wilcox. They know I have that kind of palette. Mm-hmm. And so they say, oh, have you heard of Martin Jones? Of course, the first time you go, no. And they go, really? You've never... Are you new? That's the line I used to always get.
Well, that's very nice.
We have to switch gears here for a moment because we have Tommy Emmanuel here on the phone with us. Tommy Emmanuel, this is Martin Joseph.
Hello, Martin Joseph.
Tommy, great to meet you, my friend.
Thank you.
In this way, I've seen your posters everywhere I play in the UK, but we've never met in person, I don't think.
Oh, great.
You guys have never met?
No, I've never met Tommy. No.
Really?
No.
Ah. You know he's Australian, right?
Yes, I'm good.
And you know he's playing in Ontario this week, right?
I didn't know that.
Tommy?
Yes, sir.
I miss you.
I miss you too. Are you well?
I'm doing quite well. Do you know Martin Joseph is in town playing a few gigs?
Wonderful.
You guys, I'm glad you're not competing against each other. That'd be a little awkward.
No. Well, the night before last, I played in Toronto, and Pat Metheny was on down the road. But we both did pretty well, so I think we were both happy about that.
What are the odds that Tommy Emmanuel and Pat Metheny be on the same night here in Toronto? That's just crazy. Tommy, where are you off to now?
I'm driving to Ottawa.
Right. Okay. How many more gigs do you have in Ontario?
We have Ottawa tonight, then Montreal, and then Quebec.
Fantastic. Well done. You're still packing the house out? The first time you were here, I think it was Hugh's room, and the place was just, you know, ridiculously packed, and now you're packing out, you know, the Air Canada Centre.
Well, I'm really, really pleased with how it's built here in Canada, and I love coming back and playing here. People love it, and, you know, a man's got to have a good job, you know?
If you two were ever to share the same stage, Martin, Joseph, and Tommy Emmanuel, same stage, would there be pyrotechnics, is what I want to know. Would the flash bombs go off?
It depends how pyrotechnical Martin is. You know, I'm not pyrotechnical. I'm a grassroots player who likes to have fun, you know.
I'd just let Tommy play guitar. I might sing, but I'd let him play. That's fine. I can play guitar, but not when Tommy Emmanuel's around.
You know who else is in town this week is a fellow named David Wilcox.
Oh, right. So which one? Was the blues guy?
The American.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
The guy not on drugs.
I could tell you a funny story about him.
About David Wilcox, American singer-songwriter?
I went to see him play at the Bottom Line in New York in about 1991 when I was making an album there. And there was a table in front of me reserved. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And Donald Trump walked in with Ivana. He's a huge Dave Wilcox fan.
Really?
Yeah, and they went. Yeah, he took him out in his limo during the break for a little meeting, and then came back. But it was bizarre. Donald Trump's a Dave Wilcox fan.
Who would have thunk?
How about that?
Yeah,
unbelievable.
So, I have a bottom line story too. I was playing there. I did six gigs with Robin Ford there, and I opened and did about 40 minutes. And just as I was about to go on stage on the Saturday night, I'm standing behind the curtain. And this voice says, "Here, have a good gig." And I looked down, it was Sting.
Come on.
Yeah, he was a big Robin Ford fan. He didn't know me from Adam. And anyway, I got playing the show. And when I played my Aboriginal song, Sting jumped up in the audience and danced.
Wow. Now, does he dance like an average white guy with the white man's overbite, or does he have some kind of groove to him?
Oh, no. It's it's grooving away.
Okay, all right.
Oh, yeah.
That's important
yeah.
information for me.
Absolutely.
For me to know. Listen, Tommy, this was just a random moment, but I wanted the two of you to speak to each other. Is this the first time you've ever spoken to each other?
Absolutely.
Yes,
it is.
Yeah.
I admire both of you greatly. Obviously, I met you in Australia a number of years ago when I used to live there, Tommy, and since that time, you've been on the show a number of times. Allow me to speak on behalf of myself, growing quite fond of you.
Same here, brother.
Yeah.
I like how you do what it is that you do.
Whatever the heck it is that you do, yes.
It's sincere.
Thanks, mate.
And you know what? That's the most important thing.
You've both impacted me greatly, Martin. You are known as just a bit of a freak show when it comes to your lyrics, your style, your passion, your drive, the story behind what you're saying. And, of course, Tommy is known as a freak show on guitar. And you both have absolutely... I mean, both your guitars are beat to snot. you have a lovely Loudon, and Tommy, you're still playing the Aussie, what the heck's it called?
The Maiden. Absolutely, yeah. I've got a couple of new ones in tow now. I've retired a couple of old ones.
Right.
And the new ones are even better.
Brilliant. Well, listen, we won't keep you. We know you're on your way to Ottawa. As I said, I just wanted the two of you to hook up there
Thank
for the
so
first
much.
Time ever. Martin Joseph, Tommy Emmanuel.
Thank you.
I hope you meet sometime face to
yeah,
face.
Yeah, good luck, Tommy. I hope forward to meet you in person. Thanks, buddy.
See you, Drew.
All right, see you, mate.
Bye.
Bye, mate. All right, we've got the one and only Martin Joseph here in studio with his very, very good friend, Mr. Stuart Henderson. Martin, I think the impact that you have had on people over... 25 now? No, it's got to be more than 25
it's
years.
It's 30 years now, actually.
Is it really?
In terms of this journey, Drew. But in terms of Canada, it's been the last 10 years. I came here in 99. I played a little house show in Prince George, BC. And it just organically grew from there. I got invites to play the folk festivals here. And I've since the day I came here, I felt such a connection with this country that I can't articulate to you. But I adore Canada. I love coming here. And I get to come here probably two or three times a year. And it's just this last 10 years, it's just been an absolute blessing, and I really mean that.
So what's different about the soul of Martin Joseph today as compared to 1983 when you were only beginning?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the soul has journeyed and has taken on a lot more than perhaps he understood at the time. To kind of condense it for you, I would say the majority of my songs at that time were fairly bold in that they had a lot of affirmative answers within them.
You were certain? You were more certain then?
Yeah, I was black and white, I would say. More black and white about life, more black and white about faith, about the whole thing.
Were you spiritually abrasive?
I don't think I was abrasive. I don't think that has ever been part of my character. I just think I was coming from a slightly different angle. What the guitar afforded me to do was to travel, to witness things, to see things, to feel things that my fairly safe middle class, loving upbringing had not taught me. That when you actually see people on the other end of life, and if you're going to be honest about these things, then it can have a profound effect. And I think from around about 87 onwards, my songs began to reflect questions rather than answers. And that's primarily where they are now, I think. So what's happened is the boy that was had something, maybe people would call it a gift or whatever, to communicate, he's just began to communicate different things. He moved on and saw that the world was a little bit bigger than he first thought it was.
Okay, in your certain days, mm-hmm. were those the days of Myrrh, and were you sort of Keith Green-ized?
I remember Keith Green. I remember that having a profound effect on me. And I can still listen to a Keith Green song and be beautifully moved.
That was the same journey for me. Back in those days, I call them my Keith Green days, where the black and white was the reality. That was the search. It was about finding the answer, not the journey. And that sounds a little esoteric and hug a whale, kiss a tree. But man, I just think back to the person I was then spiritually and I cringe.
Yeah.
I think now about who I am spiritually and I still cringe, but it's a different cringe. Mm.
But I don't think it's an unusual thing that we're talking about. I don't think it's just you and I that have had this.
No.
I think that anyone at the age of, I was 23, I'm nearly 50 now. And I just think that, you are bound to take on other emotions. You are bound to take on other thoughts. It's a rare thing to find a person at the age of 22, 23 who can perhaps grasps that sense of the of a wider picture beyond some of the stuff that you're beginning to take on board to begin to understand. And I don't think that that's an unusual thing, that you know that in 30 years' time you're actually going to see life, faith, whatever, from a completely different view. And in fact, if you haven't, then I would say, well, you know, where's the journey in that? Where's the growth?
I often refer to a fellow named Dr. Daniel Taylor, who has written a book called The Myth of Certainty.
Yeah.
And I guess the premise of this book is that doubt is more compatible with faith than certainty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And yet when I bring that up to many people these days, especially the apologists, especially those fine Bereans out there, that doesn't sit well with them.
It's interesting, going on from what Martin was saying there, there was an Anglican bishop in Liverpool, a man called David Shepherd, back in the... Good name for a bishop. He played cricket for England. He was a very fine man, a wonderful man. He talked about the process of continual conversions. And he came to a city, Liverpool, in the early mid-80s, was dying. It was absolutely dying. And he was regarded with great respect by both Catholic and Protestant, because Liverpool, until about 10 years ago, was a highly sectarian city. I mean, basically, Liverpool is a place for Irishmen who can swim. I mean, that's what Liverpool is. And what David Shepherd did was he managed to become this shepherd of the flock with this message of the process of continual conversion. He said that when he was sort of, single quotes, converted to Christ when he was a young man, he thought it was done and dusted. And then he was faced with the challenges of being a bishop in a poverty-ridden city. Now, Liverpool has improved since then. When he was faced with aspects of the poor and great moral issues, certainly one of the things that changed him was Christ's view of women, that women were equal partners. And contextualizing Christ within his time, what Jesus did was he turned everything on its head. I was reading your website, Drew, and you mentioned some of the characters that have inspired you. Mike Iaconelli, who was a great friend, American author and speaker, the late Mike Iaconelli. He, in fact, managed that sort of almost, it's not dualism, but it's an ambivalent war. He held to the foundation and the basics and the tenets of the faith, but basically everything was up for negotiation. Everything was up for grabs. It's funny, when I was artist in residence with my wife at an American college just outside Boston back in the 90s.
How far outside Boston?
Oh, about
you've got me wondering which college.
Oh, it's Gordon College.
Oh, thank you.
And we were writer in residence there. And then when we arrived, Mike phoned the switchboard and told the switchboard not to employ me because, in fact, I was running drugs for a Colombian cartel, and that he was completely shocked that a college of such intellectual standing should stoop so low as to employ an undesirable like me. Now, that was Mike. That was Mike. Mike and I almost got shot once in Belfast, but that's another story.
But that's another story. Well, I'm a little gobsmacked after that bit of nonsense. Folks, in the studio with Martin Joseph, who is going to sing a song for us, anything he likes. He brought his guitar, oddly enough, and Stuart Henderson's here as well. What do you all want to do?
We're going to do an example of what we're doing on stage at the moment. Stuart and I have these separate careers, but we brought a show together in the UK where we mixed poetry and music, so we're both on stage at the same time, and this is kind of an example of what we do.
And you're both doing vocals in this?
Yeah.
We have three microphones. Thank you very much.
This is called Some of Us. Some of us are fragile, and some of us have snapped, and some of us are watching, some of us are trapped, and some of us are wounded, and some of us have strayed, some of us are striving, and some have not been paid.
And some of us count blessings, some of us want more, some of us are zealous, some of us not sure. Some of us are crumpled, some of us are groomed, some of us are modest, and some of us are consumed.
It's a journey, a ramble, it's a gamble, it's a phrase, a corridor, a segment, a few hours and several days, a legacy of poverty, a mishap, what a treat, this walk of benediction, and stumble in defeat. And some of us are bluffing,
and some of us are trained,
and some of us are fruitful,
and some of us have waned,
and some of us are yawning now,
some of us are harmed,
and some of us are outcasts,
and some of us are alarmed.
It's a journey, a ramble, it's a gamble, it's a phrase, a corridor, a segment, a few hours and several days, a legacy of poverty, mishap and a treat, this walk of benediction, stumble and defeat. A gamble, it's a phrase, a corridor, a segment, a few hours and several days, legacy, poverty, a mishap, what a treat, this walk of benediction, to stumble in defeat.
And some of us know history, and some of us know none. Some of us are present, and some of us have gone.
And some of us are restless, because we wait in this place, between the veil of our circumstance, waiting for
grace.
Martin Joseph and Stuart Henderson on the Drew Marshall Show. Poignant, powerful, perceptive, precise, concise. I mean, there's a few words that could be thrown out in the mix here. How do you stop yourselves, though, from taking yourselves too seriously?
Well...
Oh, basically... We take
wait, you're from the UK.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, precisely, yeah. We just take the piss out of one.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going.
What else is there to do?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, this you know, I go on stage, sing a couple of songs, and I introduce the wisest man I know, and he comes on flailing about like some sort of... spider on acid or something.
Well,
wow.
You know, so it's not hard to laugh. I mean, you have to, because, you know, in the midst of that stuff, you know, I mean, life is joyful, life is sad. It's all of those emotions. And I think in that sense, our relationship reflects that. We can go, you know, at 3 a.m, at the end of a long day, we're talking about incredible stuff sometimes that goes deep, and yet we're laughing at the most frivolous, stupid, you know, jokes that 17-year-olds are sort of...
What's wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing wrong with that.
No,
nothing.
I'm just trying to paint the fact that, you know, when we do that, it sounds incredibly serious, but of course that's not the whole picture.
And you can only joke with someone if there's a deep bond of friendship.
Yeah.
And respect there. So basically it's not a case... It's not competitive in that way.
Why do you respect Martin?
Because of the walk that he's taken, really. It's actually quite remarkable. And also, I've seen him in situations where it's been incredibly difficult. You know, opening for big acts, when Martin was signed to Sony CBS back in the 90s. Very, very difficult to actually go on in front of an audience who's expecting Celine Dion or Chris de Burgh or Clannad. And he does his stuff, and he did his stuff. And if I may say, how he's matured into a musician of great accomplishment, but also as a lyricist as well. You know, Martin also writes his own lyrics. And the reason I respect him probably is he's taken a broad path, and the broad path is the most difficult one to take.
Martin, why do you respect Stuart at the risk of being expected a follow-up question here?
Well, I describe him as one of the wisest men I know. I love spending time with him because I learn so much on a daily basis. He's at a level, I suppose, that I can only want to be at in terms of his thinking. He's a very well-read person, where I'm sort of still struggling to find a cup of tea in the morning. He's already read half a dozen newspapers, been on the internet, trolled the world, knows exactly what he's doing. And then you could throw any subject at him right now, and he'll come back with the most amazing...
It's basically called an annoying swat.
Yes. He knows it. So his well-readness, all of that stuff. And again, his consistency, because I'm not a consistent person in many ways, and yet Stuart continues to walk a path that I could only wish for in many ways. So I look at all that and I put it together. A man who can articulate things in the most beautiful ways. Stuart has a poem about his grandmother. It's an amazing gift because the audience is rolling with laughter, with almost disdain for what it sounds like a horrible woman for about 5 minutes, and then suddenly it turns and you gain some understanding of why she has so much bitterness and hatred within her, and the place can be reduced to tears in seconds. It's an amazing gift of language and that. And I love him dearly. And if I am in some sort of crisis, then he's one of the first people I ring. So there's a number of reasons.
So you sound like a brilliant storyteller. I'm thinking of Leo Kottke, also another brilliant storyteller. David Wilcox, phenomenal storyteller. Setting up songs is key. I wonder if that's the role you play when you're out on the road. Do you set up the song, then you kick into it? Is that a reality, or is it? Do you do this kind of speak sing? What does it look like? For example, when you go to Kingston today at St. Paul's Anglican Church, or Orangeville on the 18th, Westminster United Church, or Toronto at the Kingsway Lambton United Church on May 19th, or Port Dover at the Lighthouse Festival on May 20th, what does it look like?
What's a publicist? Basically, it's a case of Martin will start with a couple of songs, I go on, do a couple of poems, and then we begin to merge our lyrics and our songs. So we have standalone material, and we have merge material. And also there's a narrative.
And sometimes we'll read a poem, and I'll just strike up a melody underneath and try and match music to what he's doing. So there's an improvisation side of it, too.
I've often said that a bad mime is a good thing to waste. You got that, Martin?
Yeah.
Not quite that.
No,
yet.
I've got
that's
that.
That's why he's
that
wise. He's wiser than me.
Yeah, I've got
I'm
that
still,
completely.
I'm still half an hour behind.
But when it comes to poetry or when it comes to poets,
yes,
poets are weird.
Yes.
Weird little things.
Yes, wandering around in sort of Panamas and smoking jackets.
Yes.
That sort of idea.
Yeah.
See, the thing is, I come from the Liverpool School of Poetry.
Does that mean there's... a lot of drinking beforehand? What does that mean?
With some of the poets, yeah. I mean, I don't drink beforehand because the lips don't work.
No. After.
Generally. Exactly. After, yeah, absolutely, yes. Gosh, lots of marzipan for me. Basically, how the Liverpool poets work or worked is, again, contextualization is everything. If you look at Liverpool in the mid-60s, after the whole Beatles thing, there was a huge oral poetry circuit. It was enormous, where you could go and hear poetry 3, 4, 5 nights a week in Liverpool. And we're getting audiences between 700-800 people a time. So,
well, this is back when everyone was high, though.
There wasn't actually. There wasn't that much drug use in Liverpool.
They clap, but they're snapped.
It was alcohol. No.
William Shatner would sneak in the back door and do a set.
No, because Liverpoolians they can rip into you. Oh, my goodness. You really have to know your stuff and be on top of your game before a Liverpool audience. Once they accept you, they're absolutely wonderful.
Okay.
I remember Allen Ginsberg came to Liverpool in 1967 and would... an over-emphatic statement, he said, Liverpool at the moment is the centre of consciousness of the universe. And everybody's going, what's he talking about? I haven't got a clue. So Liverpoolians really have a level of almost intuitive communication. And that's where I started, basically. And the object of the exercise, the object of the poem, is that it should be accessible, that the audience should get it. You're speaking the community's voice. So there's never been this sort of self-conscious sort of, scratching your backside and looking at the floor and said, I've got this poem about a geranium. It is proclamation poetry, but also capable of being sensitive. It's poetry about the human condition.
As much as I love you and your music, Martin, and you and I spoke very briefly at some theologian's office over at Wycliffe there last year, and let me just say briefly, you are the opposite of what most performers are. A good communicator / performer makes the audience member feel like they are speaking to them, and it's just one-on-one, and you have this confident charisma, and you're just stoic, and I don't know, whatever else. And then you get off stage, and they're socially retarded, and they're aloof, and they're insecure. You are very warm one-on-one, but on stage you're awkward, dude. Am I wrong? Did I pick up on that wrong?
Awkward in what sense?
I don't know. You avoid eye contact when you're on stage. You avoid intimacy, I think. You leave your intimacy for your lyrics, for your song.
I think there's a certain shyness in me, because I've often said, you know, without the guitar, I said this to Stuart last night, I'd be...
naked.
A mess in many ways. You know, my sense of self-worth, all of that stuff.
I'm okay. Also, I just helped to contribute to that right now.
Yeah, you did.
Brilliant.
That's it, I'm screwed. But I think that for a while when I'm on stage, there is an awkwardness in sense until I get to know people, and then I'll begin to look into their eyes. But it's basically, I think, well, are people going to like this?
Are you still there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a good place to be. Why should I presume people are going to love me? Why should I presume that people are going to enjoy what I do? I've seen too many people that go down that road of arrogance, and I'd certainly rather it be the way that you just said rather than the other way around.
Which is why I like you.
Because I've seen so many artists that, you know, prefers this sort of warmth, should we stay on stage or whatever it might be, and then you go off and they treat people
rubbish.
Very badly, and I've seen that many, many years, and I hate that side of stuff. So I think it takes time for me just to engage and feel that I'm accepted, that sort of thing. I think they're just insecurities that come out.
Are you...
Silence on radio. It's the best kind.
Are you a follower of Christ?
Yes, but I'm not very good at it.
Well, yeah, but I remember asking David Wilcox this question on air, and it was the most painful, arduous conversation I have ever had. You strike me as the same.
No, because I just answered your question. There's only one answer to that question for me. The answer is yes, and there is a context to that, you know, because if I'm doing an interview with Guitar Forever magazine or something, and they say, "So are you a Christian?" Then I have to think about that, because I'm not even sure that word makes any sense.
Yeah, so your quick answer to them is, tell me what
that
means to you.
I'll tell you that. I think that word has been rendered impotent and hijacked and everything else. So I don't think you'd even understand if I said yes. I much prefer the question, am I a follower of Christ? I think you could, in terms of, you know, people in the street, most people would say, well, I think he was, you know, all the rest of it. And I suppose in some ways I would like to attain to those standards and everything else. So that's a much simpler question to answer than, are you a Christian?
Yeah. Well said. Well, Stuart, now you can't be, because you work for the BBC.
Yeah, that's right. That makes me a spawn of the devil. No, but the whole BBC approach is pluralistic. Basically, he said that, he said that. You, the listeners, decide. You know, so there is such a thing as BBC balance, which is constantly running in my head. Now, during the election, general election that we just had in Britain, I wouldn't dream of expressing publicly what my political views are.
Especially if you left your mic on.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Well done, Gordon. because there may come a time in the future when I have to interview some of these characters. So if their researchers find out that I have been expressing emphatic views in favour of the Conservatives or the Lib Dems or the Labour, that puts me out of court. And the best kind of BBC broadcasting is that balance of proportion. One of the things that I was fascinated by your question to Martin, because it was a perfectly framed question. It was, where do you start? And it's a bit like saying, are you a human being? Yes, however. There is always the however qualification. I'm also aware, every time I come to North America and to Canada, there is a difference in language. For example, the word evangelical does not mean the same in Britain. Everybody shivers. It doesn't mean the same in Britain, because evangelicalism came out of basically social reform and a left-leaning understanding of society. Transpose it certainly to our friends over the border, and it means something completely different.
Tosser.
You said that, yes. I'm leaving here now. You've got to stay here, you know.
Might be a good time for a song. That's a lovely segue, I think.
You want to do a song?
Yeah, what do you think? Martin Joseph, yeah. Stuart Henderson, one together, one solo. What are they're talking, they're looking, they're flipping pages.
We've got it.
The weight of the world keeps us nervous at night, blocks up the light, makes our effort seem slight. The weight of the world is pressing us down, it's buckled your crown, it's watching you drown. Weight of the world that gouges the land and shrivels the sand and praises the bland. The weight of the world that frenzies our fears when hope disappears, we start sharpening in spears.
So is this paradise or prison? Because the verdict is unclear. We asked virtue to defend us, but she's got this new career. Selling pills to make us grateful and timeshares for the soul. She says anyone can stay there because no one's in control.
The weight of the world brings ominous thorns, serves a breakfast of thorns on funeral yawns.
The weight of the world plots the hero's defeat, mocks the quiet and discreet, the blameless and sweet.
The weight of the world demands nothing is saved, we end up enslaved to the glib and depraved.
The weight of the world likes to treasure despair, says beyond is not there, no celestial stair.
So is this paradise or prison, cause that verdict is unclear. We've asked virtue, come on, defend us, but she got a new career. Selling all the pills gonna make us grateful, and those timeshares for the soul. And she says anyone can come and stay here now, because
no one's in control.
Where we wait as a temporary base, as a chorus of grace, what a beautiful place.
The world where we wait all our burdens are brief, the black ties of grief we will soon leave beneath.
The world where we wait has miraculous powers and plenty of hours and oceans of flowers.
The world where we wait is a brief legacy, it's a quiet prophecy of our near liberty.
So is this paradise or prison, cause that verdict is unclear. And we've asked virtue, come on, defend us, but she's got a new career.
Selling pills to make us grateful and timeshares for the soul. She says anyone can stay there, cause
no one's in control. Selling all the pills that make us grateful and the timeshares for our soul. And anyone can stay there now, no one's in control.
Martin Joseph, live on The Drew Marshall Show with the one and only Mr. Henderson.
Stuart Henderson.
Stuart, the lyrics have been the drawing card for me over the years. I do appreciate music. I appreciate Martin's tonal resonance, this mellifluous junk he has in his throat. But guys like Larry Norman were formative for me in the early years. I think that's true of you, Martin.
I think for both of us have an affection for Larry.
Yeah, yes, it's a sort of, in my case, it's a rather sparse affection, yes, but certainly.
Why, because you know the dirt?
I certainly knew stories.
Larry stayed in your house once.
Yeah, Larry stayed in our house once. When he came on his first tour of Britain, stayed in our house. So this is the back streets of Anfield. No frills. Black and white television. which worked occasionally. So Larry comes, and he had a presence. He had great charisma. I remember Vince Clark from Yazoo saying Larry Norman was the best live act he'd ever seen, ever. When Larry stood on stage, he was mesmeric. He had qualities of the actor about him, the showman, the shaman, and I have great respect for him. But I was looking for consistency of behaviour. That's what I was looking for. So he stays in our house, and we had this sort of bizarre sort of experience, because he was coming from California, and sort of slightly health faddish, to a certain degree. Didn't get up before 1 o'clock, which didn't go down too well with my mother. You know, what's the matter with him?
That's why I never stay there.
Get his, you know, get his air cup, put him in the army. No, mother, it's not like that. Anyway, so anyway, he comes down to breakfast, and I used to have a budgerigar.
A what?
A budgerigar. It's like a parakeet.
Small parakeet.
Okay. I used to sort of fly around, and my father taught it to swear, but that's another story. So anyway, so this parakeet budgie thing used to come on the table for breakfast. And I used to feed it cereal.
That wouldn't have gone over well with
Larry.
No,
not at all. He reeled off all these sort of diseases that I could catch. And I was, don't you abuse this poor parakeet. You know, so...
I remember being at Greenbelt, Stuart actually interviewed Larry Norman, and it was, I still remember the answer.
He's a pain to interview.
Yeah, isn't he just?
Because you said, you asked him, how do we prepare for Armageddon?
That's right,
which sounds like a Drew question to me. And Larry kind of, you know, he brushed that hair from his face, and he said, clean up your room.
Yes.
You know your mother's been asking you to do it. A long time now, so maybe when you've done that, God will trust you with something greater.
In this case, thank you very much. That's marvelous. Thank you. That's right.
Off to Gerry Anderson.
But no, just coming to the music. Only Visiting This Planet is still an album that I would play in many times. And in those early days when I was looking around for something that beyond Keith Green. Larry was the person that inspired you, you know. And
a buddy of mine, David DeSabatino, has just put out a movie called Larry Norman the Outlaw.
Yes.
And David and I were just chatting the other week. Previewed it in Nashville, and there's I guess somebody who's doing a biography on Larry, and he's a big fan, and don't say anything bad about Larry. And then there's David, and then Randy was there, and it was just this sort of, it was like a town hall meeting at a Baptist church.
Yeah, and I think within that story, Randy Stonehill comes out of it with great grace and dignity. I love Randy very much, and he's kept quiet for years.
Yeah, the lyrics have always driven me.
Yes.
So I'd like to finish talking about me.
Certainly.
This is for you.
Okay.
This is for you.
Thank you.
And this is an analysis because I have a friend who's listening who is stoned probably right now.
Yeah.
So let's go through this, and I'd like your analysis of this. This is called Weak Season.
You read it.
Last night I ignored a teenage girl with a filthy mouth of pain. Today she lays dead in a twisted wreck, and now I'm going insane. On that very same day, a plane went down. Everyone died in the sea. Except a teenage girl who screamed for 13 hours for her floating mother among the debris. One got to live, one had to die, both had to pay a price. But for the rest of us, we're left wondering if this God we have is nice. Maybe I'm just having a weak season this year, or maybe I'm tired of living in mortal fear. No matter what I do, no matter how hard I try, the loss of love makes me cry. How does he do it? How does he choose who's had enough time? And does he leave any clues? Maybe I'm just having a weak season this year, or maybe I'm just looking for a God who can hear. The rules scare me, but the freedom scares me more. Slippery grace leaves me laying on the floor. Am I abandoned or just ignored? It's what isn't said that rocks me to my core.
Well, welcome to the band. I think what I'd say is, the sentiment there is basically everything... about which we've been talking about, the human condition. Obviously, we approach God from the sort of Christian tradition, this Gentile tradition. Jews approach God, I feel, in a more rounded way. You know, you're doing this to us, and you're charging us. You know. So I basically think you've actually said it. You know, that is a companion piece to everything that we've been talking about.
I just want to know if it's good. That's all.
I wouldn't rhyme pain and insane. That's too easy a rhyme.
Yeah, I thought it was a too easy of a get there too.
Yeah, but apart from that, it is. It's a metaphysical.
Mundane might be a little.
Yeah.
Something I could put in there.
Yeah. Oh, you could go on. But no, you've done it. It's.
But I write, and we've got to finish here because you guys got to go over to Kingston. I write in grief or in black, in darkness.
Ah, right.
And when my guts are twisted, that's when I write. I don't write when I'm cheery.
No, right. That's the point.
Well, that's what I think, but that just does that mean I have the spiritual gift of pessimism? I mean, was it?
Well, no, also there's the aspect, the great Johnny Mercer story, when he was asked how he wrote, and he said, interviewer said, Mr. Mercer, what comes first? Is it the lyric or the melody? And he said, the phone call. So there is an element of, once you reach a certain level of accomplishment, then it becomes second nature. I tend not to write for myself now. I used to write for myself. And again, it's this continual process of conversion, really. So writing is a pilgrimage.
Yeah. And long may you write that stuff, Drew, because
absolutely.
This guitar is my chief psychiatrist. You know, it's easy to joke. It's easy to celebrate. There's no great victory.
Oh, well, we have Hillsong for that.
Yeah, there's no great victory in that, right? So what you're doing is the perfectly correct way to do it. It's not. It shouldn't be unusual. It should be just, yes, of course. What else?
And don't forget, the awkward will inherit the earth.
Thank you. You just defined my dating life back in the day when I did that sort of thing. Gentlemen, not long enough. Long, but not long enough.
Next time.
Yeah, I don't think you'll do it.
I will. I will. Yeah. Just
if they shut the Gardner Express, we won't.
No. Dude, that was horrible.
That was a cracker.
I apologize on behalf of everyone driving today. Martin Joseph, martinjoseph.com. Martin is with a Y. What a pain in the butt to have to say that for your entire marketing career. Martin with a Y, joseph.com. And Stuart Henderson is traveling with the man himself. It's the Because We Can tour. And Mississauga was last night. Sorry you missed it. If you did, Kingston tonight, Orangeville. My hometown on May 18th. So I guess I'll see you there.
Absolutely. Are you going to come?
I have to come. So I live there.
Okay, fantastic.
I've had people threaten me if I didn't come. I'm kidding.
Could you bring a bottle with you?
Oh, that's already been taken care of.
Thank you very much.
And Toronto, May 19th, and then May 20th, Port Dover. So,
I also just want to say, because we're here, I come here as on my own, but this time I wanted to bring Stuart over here, because I thought it would go really well, and World Vision gave us the chance to do that, because I work with them over here. So the tour is on behalf of World Vision, and we both believe in the work they're doing, so we're promoting that through the shows, and that's going really well. People are really connecting with the issues. It's not just about talking about this stuff and being morose about it, but it's also pointing people in terms of hope in a practical way that they can make an impact.
Can you imagine how many children would have been sponsored had Annie DeFranco been sponsored by World Vision?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I told her that last year.
Yeah.
I know.
And
and that was a brilliant tour.
Well, you know, she'd get it. She would get it if she could get it. I don't know if that makes sense to you. Because she has this song, most amazing song, you check it out. It's called The Atom on her new album. And there's a line on it that says, the greatest form of blasphemy is to split the atom. So I started up a dialogue with her about that. And we went pretty far in it. She would get this. It's just all those stupid barriers that are put up and all the God speak sometimes that gets in the way. She'd get it.
So she's not washed in the blood?
I'm not sure if I am, but alone Annie DeFranco.
It just sounds gross.
She's slightly bleached.
Boys, thank you very much. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, it's our Council of Many segment. This Saturday, we are going from the sublime to the ridiculous. This week, a husband wrote in who is experiencing erectile dysfunction and wants to know if taking pills to fix the problem is unnatural and possibly unchristian. Yes, we're going there, folks. And then we're going to check. Their mics are still on. I don't want to hear them laughing. Protesting. Is it worth it? Protesting. The animals. The RSPCA shelter, whatever the heck it's called. The Prevention of Cruelty to Animal People. They got protested because they were going to kill 300 pets that had ringworm, and now they only killed 100. Is that something that Jesus people should get into? What about the sex ed? How about abortion? How about G8, G20? So, what would Jesus protest? Maybe that's the better way to ask it. And then I am Hutterite, the author of that book. Marianne Kirkby will join us. and then we're going to get a martial arts expert right after the pacifist. Do you see how this works, folks? And then Bruxy Cavey and Dr. Greg Boyd in the studio to talk about the God of War and the God of Love. Should Christians be engaged in either? We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
It always will, and now she bends to ask the question she will cut all of her days. Do what you gotta do. Do what you gotta do. Do what you gotta do to see you through this fragile world. This fragile world.